Thank you, Jeff, and thank you all for being here on this momentous issue. Let me begin with something from today's New York Times. On the front page, the following story appears. Barred from main road, Palestinians fear two-tiered system. As if that's something that's looming and not something that's already all too real. I'll just read a little bit of it because it gives you a sense of how this issue is framed in the contemporary media, which the New York Times is a leading element, needless to say. This is from the West Bank. Al Abu Safia, mayor of this Palestinian village, which is called Beit Sira, Ali Abu Safia, mayor of the Palestinian village, steers his car up one potholed road, then another, finding each exit blocked by huge concrete chunks placed there by the Israeli army. On a sleek highway, 100 yards away, Israeli cars whiz by. They took our land to build this road, and now we can't even use it, Mr. Abu Safia says bitterly, pointing to the highway with one hand as he drives with the other. Israel says it is because of security, but it's politics. The object of Mr. Abu Safia's contempt, Highway 443, a major access road to Jerusalem, has taken on special significance in the grinding Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For the first time, the Supreme Court of Israel, albeit in an interim decision, has accepted the idea of separate roads for Palestinians in the occupied areas. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel told the Supreme Court that what was happening on the highway could be the onset of legal apartheid in the West Bank, a charge that makes many Israelis recoil. I spent a lot of time reading papers, as do you, and it's important to sort of understand the nuances of these articles and to track what's happening in them. On the one hand, this article does say quite a bit. It shows what an unjust system it is. It also gives you a sense that this system is evolving in the constant direction of ever greater exclusion of Palestinians from civilized life and an ever greater two-tiered system. On the other hand, it also says that somehow this charge, even of apartheid, is something that's still looming and that makes many Israelis recoil, as though, you know, this was a forbidden and unspeakable thing. Well, I'm going to talk about change in the situation of Israel and Palestine. Change in the midst of continuity. And this is a very difficult subject because on the one hand, it really looks as though there's very little to have changed. The occupation grinds on. The so-called roadmap to develop a two-state solution goes round and round in circles. It's a roadmap to oblivion, and it keeps coming back again and again. It keeps being repeated by officials and seconded by the press, and the American political scene has changed very little in this respect. It is still necessary for any candidate for any higher office in the United States to bow and scrape before the State of Israel and pledge undying loyalty to the Israeli state, to say that Israel is our best friend, that it's the only democracy in the Middle East, that it's necessary for U.S. security interests, and so on. all of the presidential candidates try to outdo themselves in their loyalties in this respect. And one can go on and on in documenting the way in which this situation appears to be stuck and basically going nowhere. And yet I would dispute that. I think, first of all, that human history shows us that nothing remains unchanged, that all peoples, all states, all nations evolve. And despite the appearances on the surface, sometimes that evolution occurs beneath the surface and moves people along in ways that they have not yet fully comprehended, even to themselves. And I would just like to remind you that for the many years, going on 60 now, that the State of Israel has been a player in the world system, there have been a number of beliefs that have been talked about endlessly and have achieved a certain kind of axiomatic or almost or mythical status. And I know from my own case, I was born in the year 1936, so I was 12 at the time of the instauration of the State of Israel in 1948. Of course, I understood nothing of the politics at the time, but I was very much part of a community of Jewish Americans in Brooklyn, and I heard all of these things and imbibed a certain set of of principles which had an axiomatic character to them. And one was that the year 1948 was a year in which the Israeli or the Zionist settlers achieved a great and heroic military victory by turning back the Arab armies of five different countries who were bound on exterminating the Jews, that the prospect of a second Holocaust loomed once more in 1948. In fact, the Israeli Prime Minister in waiting, David Ben-Gurion, has said as much, that there was a great panic in the land, and yet somehow the Israeli soldiers and the various irregulars and the various military units prevailed, and it was a great and heroic triumph against the hordes of Arabs who would annihilate them and throw them into the sea or repeat the nightmarish Holocaust scenario. And there were other more deeply rooted mythological elements. One was the notion that the Jewish people needed a state, that the Jewish people were deprived for all these centuries of the homeland that all human beings are said to need, and that the Jewish people have been wandering ever since their expulsion from the from historic Palestine, where the Second Temple had been erected in the Hasmonean period, and by the rebellions against Rome, they had been the temple had been annihilated, had been destroyed, and the Jews had been scattered over the face of the earth, and that that scattering set into motion a number of events. One was a very protracted history of estrangement and alienation, and also set into motion the yearning for the return to the land of Zion, which goes deeper in Judaic history into the original covenant of the God Yahweh with his first patriarch Abraham, where he was promised the lands of that area and region. So it is that is a very powerful narrative, which was lent even more power by the horrific events that had ensued in the 20th century. The Zionist movement, I'm sure most people here know this, but I'll just repeat very briefly, took hold in the latter years of the 19th century and was an effort to redefine the destiny of the Jewish people in a nationalistic way and to build a nation state for them. And this nation state could be technically in various places, but there was only one part of the planet Earth that had any, you might say, gravitas or any kind of pull to the Jewish people, and that was, again, historic Palestine. So that was a question of this return of the Jews to Palestine, which was the central narrative of Zionism, and a narrative that was also deeply reinforced by the notion and the belief that only with this nation state and historic Palestine could Jewish people fulfill themselves, and the point of the State of Israel was at one level to provide a haven in a world that had persecuted Jews endlessly, but at another level to provide a framework within which Jewish redemption could take place and the Jews could finally come into their own, and not just as a people scattered over the earth, but as a true nation among the nations. And this idea had tremendous gravity, whether it was elaborated in religious terms through various forms of Jewish fundamentalism, or whether it was more in cultural terms and in the sense that the Jews had wandered long enough and they or we were entitled to this. So you have these compelling narratives about the heroic efforts of the Zionist settlers in the Yeshiva, the settlements of Palestine, and the destination of the Jewish people in their state, which still have a certain amount of gravitational pull. They certainly, obviously, still respond. Many people still respond to them. And yet, one of the things that has changed very much in the last few years, I don't want to give a precise timetable of this, it takes up too much time, but what has changed really is, and what continues to change, is that all the elements of those narratives have been progressively eroded and in some cases demolished. And it takes a while for that demolition to make its way through the consciousness. But I would like to talk a little about it and how it has happened that way and what are some of the implications. The title of this talk could be rephrased as "In Praise of History and Historians." I mean, there's an antinomy between, on the one hand, mythologization, and on the other hand, history. I mean, history is not a precise science. It's philosophically very complex, methodologically very complex, empirically very difficult, and yet there is an effort that humanity has made to understand itself, ourselves, as an evolving set of creatures, and that we understand that there are certain elements that, however difficult to ascertain, have more reality than other elements, and to the extent that they have reality, we call that the history. There has been, for instance, within the State of Israel itself, a very powerful school of revisionist historians. Two of them come to mind, one Benny Morris and the other Ilan Pape, have very different politics, by the way, and they're bitter enemies of each other. They have a very poor opinion of each other, and yet they share having made discoveries of the historical record, which show, for instance, that the year 1948 was not what we had been led to believe the year 1948 was, and that there was much more to it. And Benny Morris sort of led the way. Benny Morris is very loyal to the Israeli state, has proclaimed his ardent Zionist credentials, and yet he admits that certain really dreadful things had to happen in that fateful year, 1948, things which violated a lot of Jewish ethical precepts, but nonetheless were necessary because, as Morris says, and by the way, there's a passage in the third from last chapter of this book, about 12 pages on Benny Morris, because he gave an extraordinary interview in the Jewish Israeli paper Haaretz in 2004, that it was necessary to do these terrible things because without doing these terrible things, the great Jewish state could not arise, the State of Israel, which can be interchangeably called either a Zionist state or a Jewish state, a state which, although it has democratic foundations, is democratic foundations for one people only. And it clearly gives priority to those people. And Morris felt that it was worth it and necessary to do that. Pape didn't and doesn't. Pape has gone, I think, considerably beyond Morris, and his last book, which I have here, is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, all right? For writing this book, Pape has brought down upon himself the tremendous outrage. It is often stated with some justification that in Israel, a more open debate occurs on the nature of Zionism and the history of the Israeli state. Yes, it is true. Things like the word apartheid can be used, they can be debated in respect to the behavior of the state of Israel. On the other hand, we should not be mistaken and assume that this is a liberal or tolerant society. For saying the things that he did and for writing the book, particularly the book on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, Ilan Pappe, and I know this immediate experience because I spent an afternoon with him in 2005 and saw a great deal of what was going on. I was basically hounded out of the country with a cascade of death threats, with ostracism of very severe sort, particularly at his university at Haifa. And he now lives and works in the University of Exeter in England. So a more open society than the United States on this subject, no doubt Israel is, but a tolerant society, do not mistake yourself. And nor should it be expected to be so, because the issues here are really matters of life and death. The life and death, certainly, of the Jewish state is at stake here. And what Pape had said and what he has developed in this, it goes a long way towards demythologizing, replacing mythology with history, demythologizing the narrative of 1948. And this is why this book is really essential. Now, you can quarrel with his history, and you might say that the facts are not there or they're wrong. However, you can't say there aren't facts. The book is loaded with facts. There's a very extensive bibliography. You can check things. He had access to the minutes of various meetings that Ben-Gurion had in the year 1947 when a lot of things were planned. He even went further. He discovered something that I didn't know anything about. I guess other people did. He discovered that from 1937 on, while Hitler was massing his forces in Germany to build for the nightmare that was to be the Holocaust, there were efforts within the Zionist community in Palestine to do what you might call research. And some of the refugees from Germany and Eastern Europe who had come escaping the fascist threat and anti-Semitism and the like joined wholeheartedly with the emerging Zionist movements there, and they embarked on a 10-year study, which Pape details in chilling precision, because it's all written down, the record is there, and nobody has disputed this. What they did is they sent teams of anthropologists, quote-unquote, or social scientists, because these people were technically trained. They were trained in universities, they had PhDs and the like. They sent these teams into the Palestinian villages. In those years, as you know, the Jewish community in Palestine was very small. The great majority of the land was still occupied by Palestinians. And even at the time of the partition, the Palestinians occupied about 80% of the land. I don't have the figures exactly in my head, but that is a very, very large proportion. The partition gave the Zionists, the Israeli Jews, a disproportionate amount of the land, and then they went ahead and ended up with a lot more than what the partition agreement of 1947 promised them. But what they had been doing between 1937 and 1947 was carefully mapping, both physically and also ethnographically, every village in Palestine, so that when the troubles arose in 1947, they had 10 years behind them of very detailed and extremely precise maps of every little town in Palestine, not just maps of every street and every corner and where the water supply was and where the chickens were kept and so on, but maps of the people, the power structure, and who was in charge and which conflicts were present and whom you could get rid of and destabilize this town. All of these things were very precisely worked out. It was quite remarkable. It was also a bit chilling because they came and took advantage of the legendary hospitality of Arab peoples that, you know, they would come and say, oh, we're just scientists, we want to study, we want to get to know you better, and they would be welcomed by the unsuspecting Palestinians who did not realize that what these people were doing, the so-called social scientists, was gathering a roadmap of another sort that would be used in precise detail in the year 1948. And what Pape details, first of all, is something that is widely accepted now, although it was certainly a strange notion to me, who had heard just the opposite for so many years, namely that the Arabs were in no way prepared to really contest this. They were merely divided against themselves. I'm not making a play for their virtue, but they were very, very weak in proportion to what they were alleged to be. They had no real chance. That they were never taken seriously by the Zionists. There was a, on the other hand, an effort to define an increasingly forward-moving terroristic strategy on the part of the Zionists, which took up immediately not just the lands that were assigned to the Jews by the United Nations, but actually was going to go out and get the rest. And in getting the rest, they were going to use all these maps, and they did it with an extreme degree of precision, ardor, high degree of organization. I mean, if that's a virtue, then they were virtuous. But what was being said at the same time is very chilling. I mean, because you can see their discourse shifting into the same patterns that had been now used by the Israeli state for every year of the 60 years after 1948, up to this latest Supreme Court ruling, which like a python squeezes the Palestinian community yet further. And you realize that what's going on here is a very systematic and highly organized and highly directed pattern. And I think we've become perhaps dulled by this, by the endlessness of it. 60 years is not that long, but it's also a long time, and thousands of things have happened. There's always one pattern, which is that the Israeli state will back off under certain circumstances if they feel that it is not opportune at that moment from making some kind of tactical move, but strategically they have one goal and have only had one goal from the very beginning, and that is to eliminate everything that is non-Jewish from the land of historic Palestine, and to reclaim and regain that promise that they felt was owed to them and which was necessary to them by virtue of the sufferings of the Jews. So Pape details this. He shows how their formal strategy changed very deliberately from retaliating. At first they would just wait until something was done to them, and then they would fight back, and then to a strategy in which they would go after the villages and make examples, that they would invade, have a few test cases. They would blow up some houses. They would blow up houses in the middle of the night while the inhabitants were sleeping. They were deliberate, and it's all written out, that we will go after them to begin with, and we will not discriminate between men, women, and children. There is no discrimination between regular militias or armies and civilians. In other words, they were immediately moving into that pattern of forward, you know, aggressive, preemptive warfare that has been the mark of aggressive states ever since and remains the mark of Israel. Now, this lesson could be learned again and again, and I do urge you to read Pape's book, because we're coming, for any time you should read Pape's book and study what he and there are others have come up with to revise this situation and replace the mythology of poor little Israeli settlers facing these barbarian Arab hordes and fighting them off heroically with the actuality, which was this is very highly organized, long-range planning using cold, calculated, tremendously highly organized, etc., but nonetheless centered on that one goal, which is to eliminate all things non-Jewish and specifically all things Palestinian from that land, and they will not stop. They cannot stop. That's important to realize. You should not think of Israel as a state that can be appeased in this regard. Israelis, yes, I'm talking about, yes, the individuals, and there are many people who have different points of view, but the state formation, just as the United States cannot stop making aggressive imperial warfare because of the institutional structures and the ways in which we are built, namely as an expansive, aggressive capitalist power. Same it is with the Israeli state, and you should not feel that it is a normal state in that respect. You have to accept it and do something, accept the reality, and then say, well, am I going to try to change it, or are we going to just live with it? But you must not kid yourself. This is what you're taking on. This is a state that is centered around the replacement of Palestinians and everything non-Jewish by a purely Jewish structure as far as they can go. Now, what about the other legitimating myth that the Jewish people had some kind of right to this, that there's a whether you calculate this according to the logos of the Bible, the Old Testament, or whether you calculate it according to the modern history, that somehow they are entitled to this. Well, this, of course, rests upon a couple of foundations which have always been assumed to be axiomatic, namely that there is such a thing as the Jewish people, okay? That the Jewish people has a nation in waiting, so to speak, and it only needs a land, a territory, to fulfill itself. Well, it's quite remarkable. I don't know how many of you have read this. I haven't read it in the original because it's in Hebrew, but a historian in Tel Aviv, a man named Shlomo Zand, has recently come out with a book which I can't transliterate English into Hebrew. I'll just read the English translation, which is, the book is called When and How the Jewish People Was Invented. Now, Zand is a born Israeli. He's a historian, eminent historian, actually of modern Europe, but he became rather puzzled by certain things and he decided to break with his narrow study of modern French history at the University of Tel Aviv and to start exploring this feature of when and how the Jewish people was invented. And he comes up with some very remarkable notions. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that he's proven his case because it's a very tough case to prove, and it's written in Hebrew, and that'll have to happen in the fullness of time, and we have to have some faith that the process of inquiry will come to grips with it. But some of the things that Shlomo Zand says are very compelling, in part because they correspond, I guess, to me, because they correspond with some things I thought of myself, but not from the same depth that he has thought of it, because he has a better knowledge of all this. I mean, it's always seemed to me that looking at myself and the people in my Jewish community in Brooklyn and people, and looking at the Jewish Americans in this room and the Jewish Americans around the world and the Jewish Americans and the Jewish wherever, you know, Ukrainians and Poles and so on, who made the state of Israel, that it's a very tenuous piece of work to say that somehow we Jews were the descendants of the Jews who were in Palestine at the time of the first century and who were allegedly expelled by Rome. And in fact, Zand goes even further and he says, you know what? He says, there was no expulsion. The Jews weren't expelled by Rome. Yes, there was a rebellion and the temple was broken down and that was a serious blow. But nonetheless, if you look at the history of the world, things of this sort have happened countless times. I mean, you know, nations rise, nations fall, temples rise, temples fall. You know, people have been at war, which is the kind of species we are. We have to contend with it, but that's the reality. But as to the example of somehow inaugurating a historical process that was this diaspora, which is now like a gigantic bellows that first expands and then contracts and brings the Jews back to the Holy Land, There's a lot missing there, and at the very least, Zand establishes quite clearly that there's just not enough to hang your hat on, you know. And I've often felt that I always liked the story of the Khazars. Khazars was a kingdom of a very powerful kingdom. It sort of extended. This is sort of in the transition period from the Byzantine Empire to the Ottoman Empire. There were many peoples in Central Asia and Asia Minor and so on. This one of them was the kingdom of Khazars. And in the 8th century, this is a rather powerful kingdom, actually converted en masse to Judaism. And what Zand comes up with, and I think this is quite interesting, is that although I had always felt that the Jewish religion was not a proselytizing religion. That is to say, that's for the Christians. The Jewish religion, we're preserving the purity of our racial entity and the people. No, that's not the case. And in fact, I remember reading a history of Muhammad, biography of Muhammad, and that found the formation of the Islam. And the Prophet Muhammad was constantly encountering Jewish people in Saudi Arabia and in Yemen, and the people he were encountering called themselves Jews, but hey, they weren't in any kind of diaspora. They were kings. They had their own countries there. They were big players on the stage at the time. And another thing is that Zahn discovers is that the puts the pieces together more than discovers, is this notion that, where did the Jews of North Africa come from? Did the Jews of North Africa come from Palestine? And he says, no, the best knowledge we have is that they come from Berber tribes people, that they were the indigenous people of North Africa. So that instead of what we say call the Jewish people, you have a great many peoples who share only a label as a Jewish religion that they ascribe to, and that they did so in an active way. In a way, it's to the credit of Judaism as a powerful religion that is enabled to draw into itself a great many people. And it always baffled me how it could be that somehow 3 million Jews were in Poland, 3 million Jews were in Ukraine, when none of us looked at all Semitic. You know, I even had my DNA tested. From the National Geographic, and lo and behold, it's daddy DNA. It goes up through Palestine, but that was 20,000 years ago. It goes through Palestine, and then it ends up in Macedonia, Bulgaria, and Ukraine, which is eventually where the Khazars came from also. Now, again, this is not to say that this is a proven hypothesis, but what it is to say, because it most certainly is not, but it is to say that it begins to look as if there really was no such thing as a Jewish people who had an identifiable national claim, much less a biblical claim. We've often said, well, so the God promised, so that's just anybody can say that God promised. But this goes beyond that. It's also, is this really an identifiable national group, or rather, are there many national groups that are scattered around, or subnational groups, who happen to share a certain religion? The same way you wouldn't say that there is an identifiable Christian type, because there are so many groups who are Christians. I mean, there are Jews in India, and there are Jews in Iran. There were Jews in Iraq from the 8th century BCE, and all of these people were Jews, and they all had a very rich and complex and wonderful history. Let me say parenthetically, because this isn't the main point I want to get at, that I think one of the greatest indictments of the State of Israel is the way it has erased that very fantastically interesting complexity and livelihood and vitality of Jewish cultures that existed all around the world. I remember at college when I met my friend George, and he said, "I'm Jewish," but you don't look Jewish. Wait, you really look Jewish, he was a Sephardim. And I said, "Oh, this is fantastically interesting. I wouldn't know that his type would be second or third class citizens within the State of Israel. I wouldn't know the Ethiopian Jews that went up there. There are many different kinds of Jews." It's a very interesting book, very massive scholarly book, edited by David Bialy of the University of California, called Cultures of the Jews. There is no single Jewish culture. That's the main point. There are many, many interesting Jewish narratives and cultures. And the State of Israel, for a number of reasons, one of which was that it was an attempt and the most important, of the Jews of Eastern Europe and Central Europe, the Ashkenazim, who were the Jews who had the Yiddish civilization, of which I am one, but no necessary connection to the Jews of ancient Palestine. In fact, who has the necessary connection to the Jews of ancient Palestine? The Palestinians. The very Palestinians that are now living third rate or subhuman existence, because they're cut off from all elements of state life and power, are undoubtedly descendants of the people who happened to live there at the time of the first century. And many of them became Christians, and few of them stayed Jewish, and many of them then became Muslims later on. So this puts a different light on it, doesn't it? And in fact, there was a further study has shown that actually the notion that there is a Jewish people is an artifact of 19th century nationalism. The 19th century was a period in our history when, largely in my view, because of the onrush of capitalism. See, capitalism came into this full flower in the 19th century, and what capitalism does, as Marx says, it dissolves everything. It dissolves all communities, it dissolves identities. All that is solid melts into air, is this famous line from the Communist Manifesto. And I think we have to appreciate that people get frightened and upset, and this, the whole age of fundamentalisms and nation buildings that we live under is to be seen in the light of the expansion of capitalism and its dissolution of communal ties and its erosion of identities, because it is very difficult now to hold on to any firm identity, and loyalty between generations and relations between genders and the kinds of rules that tie people together and give their lives coherence and meaning are constantly eroded by commodity civilization. And this was happening in the 19th century. People could see a big breakup coming, which indeed it was the case, as we know. And Zionism was one such fruit and one such offshoot. And in that sense, it's to be understood as such, but certainly not to be elevated to the status of something that has that kind of claim. As to what Professor Zond was trying to do, let me just read you something. This is from an interview, again, in Haaretz, which he says, the interviewer says, well, why are you doing this book? And I'll just read from it. It's an interesting statement. The supreme paradigm of exile, says Hassan, was needed in order to construct a long-range memory in which an imagined and exiled nation race was posited as the direct continuation of the people of the Bible that preceded it, Sand explains. Under the influence of other historians who have dealt with the same issue in recent years, he argues that the exile of the Jewish people is originally a Christian myth that depicted that event as divine punishment imposed on the Jews for having rejected the Christian gospel, the divinity of Christ, and so on. Hassan continues, I started looking in research studies about the exile from the land, which was a constitutive event in Jewish history, almost like the Holocaust. But to my astonishment, I discovered that it has no literature. The reason is that no one exiled the people of the country, and so on. And then he talks about the Palestinians. But then he goes into, later on, why do you think the idea of the Khazar origins is so threatening? It is clear, says Sassan, that the fear is of an undermining of the historic right to the land. In other words, the right claimed by Zionism. The revelation that Jews are not from Judea would ostensibly knock the legitimacy for our being here out from under us. Since the beginning of the period of decolonization, settlers have no longer been able to say simply, we came, we won, and now we are here, the way the Americans, the whites in South Africa, and the Australians said. There is a very deep fear that doubt will be cast on your right to exist. And the interviewer says, who's Jewish, Israeli, from Haaretz. Is there no justification for this fear? Zahn says, no. I don't think that the historical myth of the exile and the wanderings is the source of the legitimization for me being here, and therefore I don't mind believing that I am Khazar in my origins. I am not afraid of the undermining of our existence, because I think that the character of the State of Israel undermines it in a much more serious way. What would constitute the basis for our existence here is not mythological historical right, but rather would be for us to start to establish an open society here of all Israeli citizens. The interviewer goes on, in effect, you are saying that there is no such thing as a Jewish people. Zahn replies, I don't recognize any international people. I recognize the Yiddish people that existed in Eastern Europe, which, though it is not a nation, can be seen as a Yiddishist civilization with a modern popular culture. I think that Jewish nationalism grew up in the context of this Yiddish people. I also recognize the existence of an Israeli people and do not deny its right to sovereignty, but Zionism and also Arab nationalism over the years are not prepared to recognize it. From the perspective of Zionism, this country does not belong to its citizens, but rather to the Jewish people. And that's the problem with Israel. It belongs not just to the Jewish people in Israel, but to all Jewish people everywhere. That's a fundamental point. And that's, this is now me, Covell, speaking. That's the reason that they talk so much about criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, because Israel postulates that Israel is ipso facto the nation of all the Jews everywhere. Therefore, if you criticize Israel, you're criticizing all the Jews everywhere, which is the primary meaning of anti-Semitism. But obviously, that claim that Zionism makes, namely that it is the state of all the Jews everywhere, is a claim whose value can be contested. I mean, is that really the case? Should that be the case? Why should it be true just because a Zionist says it so? What's your proof of that? Now here Zond is saying there's no way any state can be the state of all the Jews everywhere, because the Jews are everywhere are such different kinds of people. Okay? And if you're saying it's the state of the Ashkenazi Jews, then you might say, well, what the hell are you doing in historic Palestine? Why don't you work it out somewhere else in Belarus, or you know, figure it out? Anyhow, to return to Zond. From the perspective of Zionism, this country does not belong to its citizens, but rather to the Jewish people. I recognize one definition of a nation, a group of people that wants to live in sovereignty over itself. But most of the Jews in the world have no desire to live in the state of Israel, even though nothing is preventing them from doing so. Therefore, they cannot be seen as a nation. What is so dangerous about Jews imagining that they belong to one people? Why is this bad? Zond goes on. In the Israeli discourse about roots, there is a degree of perversion. This is an ethnocentric, biological, genetic discourse, but Israel has no existence as a Jewish state. If Israel does not develop and become an open, what he means to say, if Israel keeps proclaiming itself as a Jewish state, it will eventually cease to exist, because it's just, you can't, it's like squaring the circle. You can't make it happen in the modern world. If Israel does not develop and become an open, multicultural society, we will have a Kosovo in the Galilee. The consciousness concerning the right to this place must be more flexible and varied. And if I have contributed with my book to the likelihood that I and my children will be able to live with the others here in this country in a more egalitarian situation, I will have done my bit. We must begin to work hard to transform our place into an Israeli republic where ethnic origin as well as faith will not be relevant in the eyes of the law. Anyone who is acquainted with the young elites of the Israeli Arab community, that's the 20% of the state of Israel that happens to be non-Jewish and non-Ashkenazi. The young elites of the Israeli Arab community can see that they will not agree to live in a country that declares it is not theirs. If I were a Palestinian, I would rebel against a state like that, but even as an Israeli, I am rebelling against it. I think this is quite remarkable, both for what he says and also for why reasons he gives for saying it. I think we're seeing here, the main point I want to drive at, is that as time has gone on, and this is why I say that things are not so static, as time has gone on, the legitimacy and intellectual coherence of the notion of the Zionist state as being right and just for the Jews, as being in some ways a boon to the world, of having some kind of fundamental basis in human history, is being constantly eroded. And I think what we're seeing, what strikes me in what Shlomo Zond is saying, is that this is obviously not a particularly political or radical guy. He's a family man, he's a scholar. But he has a conscience of a certain sort. He has a very good conscience that he wants to ally his future with the future of a human order that is not based upon narrow ethnicity or any religious superiority, but is based upon the idea of universal human right. And he would like to share that with the Palestinian people who live within the state of Israel now, or live within the occupied territories, which is, of course, another element, but not fundamentally different, is it? Because these are different phases of the respective purification or nation building within this entity that is so contested around the world. So this is my way of coming around to the fact that when I write this book, which I didn't use the discourse of Shlomo Zond, because they didn't have the historical clarity, but I came to many of the same conclusions, and I think that many people can come to these same conclusions. The subtitle of the book, Overcoming Zionism, is Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. There are many pathways to that. It is not a kind of unitary notion. It is not some kind of dogma or blueprint. It is a goal. It is a goal that sees beyond the sadly fragmented, truncated, and very limited way of being that has arisen in too many places in the world, and including the State of Israel. I include Islamic, states also. You know, the State of Iran, similar. The idea that a state should be for a certain kind of people is a barbaric idea, which has been revived in our time. Because, in my view, and you may find this a little extreme, because in my view, people have been unable to see beyond capitalism, and so they live within a capitalist world which is constantly breaking down identities and senses of meaning and purpose and community. And in order to maintain a hold on their dignity as human beings, they declare themselves, I am this kind of person, and I'm going to kick the shit out of anybody who stands in my way, and I'm going to build my nation state on this ground. This is a regression, but it's understandable, all right? In that sense, the formation of the State of Israel is understandable, particularly in light of the Holocaust, although there's no justification for building a state wherein you oppress another people who never did you any harm simply because you had been oppressed. Falling into that trap is what creates the endless woe and distress that is inherent in the State of Israel has led to the fact that it has never once in all of its 60 years not had a state of emergency, that it's been unable to declare a constitution for itself, because if it declared a constitution, it would have to sign on to the lists of universal human rights, and if it did that, it would have to abolish itself. You know, it's that simple. So they have a court which finally gets around to ratifying what the system has done. It's really amazing to talk about the Supreme Court now saying, well, we might put this in law. It's been in fact. The Israelis always create these facts on the ground. One thing that emerged in 1948, as Pape describes it, is that Ben-Gurion and his generals were brilliant improvisers. Things would break out, they would go and take an advantage, and then they would pin it down, and next thing you know, that would be a fact on the ground, and next thing you know, there'd be a law certifying it. So there's this process which holds it all together. In any event, that process is really coming to an end. One reason it's come to an end is that the notion of a two-state solution, which has been the alpha and omega of enlightened politics on this subject for a long time, has pretty much collapsed. I spent a lot of time reading the internet on the Israeli-Palestine situation. And by the way, there's a lot of superior stuff there. You do not have to rely upon the pathetic, you know, Zionist New York Times or the official media or our politicians. There's a great deal that is said on the internet. I do put in about an hour a day reading this stuff, and I wish I had a secretary who could do a content analysis for me. But I know that over the years that I've been doing this is an increasing crescendo of comments saying this two-state solution is just pointless. We have to give up on it. It's not going to work. And correlative with that, there is the notion that we have to somehow think of transforming the State of Israel in itself so that it can be a state of all of its citizens. That's all we mean by a one state. By a one state, I, in any event, certainly don't mean now a Palestinian state that would push the Jews to the sea. The Israelis have earned their nationhood. However, they've earned it through a history that has been one of domination, ethnic cleansing, and the like. And it's going to require, just as it required for the Boers of South Africa, it's going to require a considerable process of inward reflection, truth and reconciliation, undoing of this past. The young woman who was talking about Zakrot before, is she here? Yes. Yeah, I met Eitan Bornstein, who is the director of Zakrot, and I think I'm going to have brunch with him Sunday morning, so I assume he's going to be doing that event. You really should speak to this man. That's what Zakrot means. It is his Hebrew word for remembering, but not just in sort of a abstract way, you know, like I remember the date of my mother's birthday, but no, remembering something that your own soul has been embedded in and transforming through memory. Okay, it's not an objectivistic memory, it's a subjectivized memory. And Zakrut does these things. They go around and they put up the place names of the Palestinian towns. You know there are 531 Palestinian towns. It's a little hard to count because some, 531 of these towns had been wiped out, mainly in 1948. Can you imagine? That's the fruit of that social science that took place over the previous decade, that they could isolate those 531 spaces. And now they're mostly just a few paving stones, occasional gravestone, occasional ruins of a church or a mosque or something like that, but mostly gone. And Pape has these very poignant accounts of how you come upon them. But what the Krat is trying to do is to actively remember this sort of thing. This is the process that can regain a sense of wholeness and a sense of responsibility, because I do believe that the Israeli Jewish people of Israel are capable of transcending their past, but it's going to require a lot of work and there's going to be pain involved. I don't mean violent pain, because I don't see that as the route, but I do think, this is why I'm saying, that you have to be very firm about this and have the courage to support a regime of boycotts, a regime of divestments, a regime of sanctions, to teach these people that they have to rejoin the human community. They have to undo this terrible mistake that they made when they thought they could build that kind of a nation state through the ethnic cleansing of another people who had never done them any harm. And they set themselves on this path towards ruin, but also a path towards possible redemption. Because you can see happening to people like Bornstein, people like Zahn, many, many people within Israel. Israel has a very weak left, so to speak. But there's a lot of people there who are very unhappy with the way things have been. And they realize that there can't be a two-state solution. And I think there shouldn't be a two-state solution if it preserves the Jewish state as such, because a Jewish state is an impossibility that only creates violence and ethnic cleansing. So if you simply have a Palestinian state and an Israeli state that's kind of like the given state, it's not going to solve anything. In fact, what will likely happen in that Israeli, let's say the state of Israel now exists, would be the Israeli state and the West Bank would be the Palestinian state. How that could be, I don't know, because the West Bank is uninhabitable pretty much. You can't, and how can you put a coherent body together? And where's the sovereignty there? Where's the real state? We're not talking about a Bantustan now, but a real state. Okay, very, very impossible in my view. But what about the Israeli state? If the Israeli state retains its identity as a Jewish state, and there's a Palestinian state next to it, who is here who can say this will not happen, that they will not then say, well, we have 20% of these Palestinians, we should get rid of them, send them across the border to their Palestinian state? I know Palestinians who live in Israel. They're very, very, they're very worried about this. They hear it, they're not making it up, because they hear it on the radio, they see it in the papers. The notion of transfer, very much, it's deeply built into the inner workings. So I think the hard thing is we have to think of a way to get beyond the Jewish state. You break the chains of Zionism, which says that Jewish people have to have this Jewish state. Well, if there's no Jewish people in the first hand, so why should they have to have a Jewish state? They can have a democratic state in which their identity can be preserved. There are Israelis now who have a Jewish background, and they can make a better world, but we're all going to have to work really hard at it, and it's going to be very, very difficult. But I do submit the times are changing. Thank you.